Welcome. The peace revolution now continues.
Breaker, breaker, 1-9. I'm in outer space with a microphone.
Yes, sir. All right. I'm coming. Hold your horses. Yeah. Ira, how'd you get this number?
No, I'm doing this one on my own. I got new partners. Jack Colton and Joan Wilder. We're romancing a new kind of stone called the Jewel of the Nile. I practically got it in my hands right now. The only thing stopping me is this big shot Arab who stole it. And is not too thrilled to part with it. But that's only the tip of the iceberg.
The headquarters of that club is London. Because it is a virtual monopoly, De Beers cannot operate legally in the United States. All sight holders must travel here to buy their rough gems, to a building known only as 17 Charterhouse Street. This is a fortress where 80% of the world's gem diamonds are sorted, graded, and sold.
Diamonds. Timeless. Beautiful. Symbols of love. They are the world's most precious and sought after gems.
In today's market, a stone like this is probably a $15 million diamond.
But in Africa during the 1990s, these beautiful stones became blood diamonds, named not for their color, but for their cost in human conflict and suffering.
Literally millions of people have lost their lives as a result of blood diamonds.
They put us together and ordered our arms chopped off.
You hear people crying, rebels attacking them, women being brutalized, people being shot at.
Children were kidnapped and turned into killers.
She staggered back and we entered the house. I took the woman's baby from the house. She later died and I felt so sorry for that baby.
When the story broke, a global industry would come under fire.
They feared that diamonds would become the new fur, that people would boycott diamonds, they were the most politically incorrect jewelry you could think of.
This is the true story of blood diamonds.
They are the hardest natural substance known to man, and one of the most valuable. For the rich and famous, they're a sign of power and prestige. And for lovers, they're an enduring emblem of faithfulness.
A diamond is a symbol of love. It's the ultimate symbol of love.
Every year, millions of dollars are spent reinforcing the message that diamonds are forever.
Sean Connery as James Bond 007. And as usual, he's not alone.
Well, that's quite a nice little nothing you're almost wearing. I approve.
I don't dress for the hired help.
From the diamond fields of South Africa.
Curious how everyone who touches those diamonds seems to die.
But behind the romance and glamour, there is a darker story.
Within this game of counterterrorism, which is really a game, a very sick game, we create what is called, under Kissinger, strategic tension. We create strategic tension so we have a legitimate use, reason to go into a country to either invade, suppress, or extract whatever mineral rights. Now, let me give you an understanding. Let me say it very clearly. Osama bin Laden was on more than one payroll. He was not only the CIA payroll, British payroll, but guess whose other payroll he was on, Alex Jones?
The Israelis.
The Wildcats. You got it. And he had relationships with Jews in the Middle East, in the diamond business, and Israel will go absolutely nuts. But the New York Times article years ago even reported how a lot of his own money came out of the Jewish diamond dealers in Tel Aviv.
Its history begins at Kimberley, South Africa in 1871. Until that year, mines had been few, and diamonds truly rare, mostly from India and Brazil. But the Kimberley find was huge. Among those who rushed to make their fortunes were two young Englishmen.
Charles Donnell Rudd, my great-grandfather, and Cecil Rhodes met here in October 1871. They were early in the rush here, and they would have found an anthill mining camp, and as Rhodes described it, as Stilton Fees, as the claim holders dug down into this enormous diamondiferous kimberlite pipe. But their eyes were more directed towards De Beers mine, which is about a mile over the horizon there. And that's where they dealt with the farmer De Beer. And they bought that farm out for £6,000. The thoughts of Rhodes immediately began to concentrate on the amalgamation of all these individual claim holders. And by 1880, he had amalgamated all the claim holders on his mine, the De Beers mine. And that began the amalgamation of all the diamond mines, and the formation of De Beers Consolidated Mines began in 1888.
What Cecil Rhodes had launched was a diamond cartel. It was based on an earlier French scheme to monopolize copper, buying up mines, restricting supply, and raising prices. From its first headquarters in Kimberley, De Beers bought out almost every other large mine in South Africa. But shortly before the First World War, diamonds were found over the border to the north in German Southwest Africa. A young German-born diamond dealer in South Africa went there to investigate. His name was Ernest Oppenheimer.
Ernest Oppenheimer, in 1914, 2 months before the outbreak of war, went there to survey the territory and came back with a report that was mind-boggling and subsequently hidden from the public. The fact that this was the richest diamond field in the history of the world. It was an alluvial field, meaning diamonds were on the surface, you could go pick them up.
But what are these organizations? Who founded them? And what are the stated goals of each? Before we begin with the Council on Foreign Relations, let's delve further into history to understand roundtable groups and their origins.
Its roots go way, way back in history, and they go back to the formation of a secret society, a secret organization that was created by Cecil Rhodes, very powerful and very wealthy individual. And people have heard about him in history, and they know about the Rhodes Scholarship, and they think, well, isn't that nice? But they don't understand at all what that's all about. Cecil Rhodes, when he died, left his great fortune not to his family, not to his heirs, but for the creation of a secret society. And we know about this because there were some people very intimately involved with this organization who wrote about it. One of the best authors on this topic is Professor Carol Quigley. He wrote several books, and Tragedy and Hope is the best known of his. He described in detail the secret organization created by Cecil Rhodes, and he explains in these books he knows about them because he was invited by the organization into its inner circle. He was never a member of it, but he was invited in as their historian, and he was allowed to see their secret records and papers and study them for several years. And he knew all the important players, and he understood what it was about, and so he wrote these books. It's an amazing thing because he laid out in great detail what the purpose of the organization was and how they were the major players in all of the big international events since and including World War I. The bottom line is that you take the roots of that organization and you find out that they created in all of the British dependencies what they call roundtable groups. And then around those little roundtable groups, they created front groups. And the purpose of these front groups and roundtable groups was to penetrate into the governments of all of these different countries, to penetrate into the media centers, to penetrate into the educational systems. In other words, to penetrate into the social fabric, the power centers of society, and literally take them over from the inside without anybody being aware that they were controlling influence.
There is a peaceful solution called peace revolution. Now let's take back
America. There's a war and we're in it. I know we can win it, so let's take back America. There was a dream, so believe it, and get ready to receive it. Now let's take back America.
Welcome to the Peace Revolution Podcast. I'm your host and navigator, Richard Grove, and this is where we step out of the confusion, fear, and anxiety of everyday life to relax into some knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. You're listening to Podomatic's number one rated podcast for higher education, and I think that the relevance of this episode to almost everyone we know is about to help this podcast grow. Peace Revolution and all the media we create here at TragedyandHope.com is presented without corporate sponsorship and is provided commercial-free and free to the public. Thanks to the generosity of the subscribers, the Tragedy and Hope online community, and the hard work of the media hosts at TragedyandHope.com. If you enjoy this podcast and find it rewarding, please share it with anyone you think might be interested, or anyone who buys diamonds or receives them as gifts to represent love. I also encourage you to check out the episode notes, references, and links for this and all episodes we publish at peacerevolution.org. I invite you to click on the invitation link in the episode notes and participate in the Tragedy and Hope online community, wherein you can sharpen your intellectual self-defense skills while enjoying a fear-free zone in which to practice these new arts of liberation and learning. Now, to the questions that we're all seeking to better understand and answer for ourselves. What role do diamonds play in supporting the system which is the status quo? How does giving our hard-earned dollars to an international cartel of gangsters represent our best idea of how to invest 2 months' salary? Why would someone demand a diamond as a proof of love? Where did we formulate such ideas, or were ideas formulated in our minds before we were even aware of such questions? Does our ignorance or nescience of the issue of diamonds in some way serve to incarcerate not only ourselves, but also countless others around the world? These are questions that I had not asked myself at one point in my life, and like many of you, I was likewise under the impression that the impressions made by media, Hollywood, and advertising as to the notion of diamonds are forever was actually true. And that's not accidental. What we're observing is evidence of psychological warfare that has affected everyone we know. Janine Roberts, in her excellent book, Glitter and Greed, The Truth About Blood Diamonds, describes how the De Beers cartel manipulated the British royal family like puppets, whereby the royal family stored away all of its other gems and started pushing diamonds into the mind of the public, in reality becoming pushers of yet another myth. Public relations and advertising campaigns were waged within American high schools during World War II, and while our boys were off fighting the American and British-sponsored Nazis, the Germans, who were also in the De Beers cartel since the days before World War I, were running psyops in our schools, teaching children that they needed a diamond to validate their provisional self-esteem, and that since diamonds were a girl's best friend, that therefore diamonds must also be forever and thus equated with love. When George Orwell was writing 1984 back in 1948, he could have been reading from the De Beers playbook, using doublespeak and doublethink to control the minds of the world audience, all of whom since buy diamond engagement and anniversary gifts, spending thousands of dollars, which most people don't even have, so they have to borrow it to spend it, without even thinking for a second, considering their actions. This is pure cynicism, the parroting of that which we've heard without validating any of the essential facts for ourselves. This is why it's our duty to question the status quo, of which the diamond and its myth are an essential part, because if we leave these ubiquitous yet recently adopted traditions to linger any longer without being questioned, we might never be able to escape our captors. Stockholm Syndrome is a dynamic in human psychology whereby when somebody is abducted, instead of trying to escape, they learn to love their servitude and their masters. If this sounds familiar, it was Aldous Huxley's foreword to Brave New World and his speech at Berkeley, The Ultimate Revolution, wherein he described how in the future, which is now, people would be conditioned, manipulated, and brainwashed into loving their servitude. Psychological warfare preys on people who do not have a methodology of observation and critical thinking. Psychological warfare originates in believing things which are not true or refusing to recognize that which is true. This is why learning to use the trivium, a process first defined by Aristotle, and also then after learning the trivium, learning how to apply logic and recognize fallacies in the arguments made by those who irrationally justify captivating us, and the way that we're kept captive is indirectly through the status quo, not directly in chains. So let's look at the status quo through the lens of diamonds and apply logic in an attempt to discern the reason behind the actions of the diamond cartel. Herein, I offer the next 15 points as components, which, if understood, will, for the most part, fill in the blind spots as created as a result of the cartel's psychological warfare over most of the 20th century. Number 1. Cecil Rhodes set up the De Beers Diamond Cartel. Number 2. Rhodes's will created the Rhodes Scholarships and Council on Foreign Relations. Number 3. Rhodes's secret society was based on the military strategy of the Jesuits. Number 4. Rhodes was a Freemason. Number 5. Freemasonry was infiltrated by the Illuminati, and the Illuminati strategy is also based on the military strategy of the Jesuits. Number 6. Moses Hess in 1862 writes that the Illuminists were progressing their agenda to create Israel in the current land of Palestine from within the Freemasonic lodges. Number 7. The Rothschild banking family is specifically mentioned in Hess's 1862 publication as being key participants in the plan to create Israel. Number 8. The Rothschild family funded Cecil Rhodes. Number 9. Lord Rothschild is named in an early version of Rhodes's will. Number 10. Lord Rothschild was instrumental in the Balfour Declaration and the future creation of a Zionist state in the land of Palestine. Number 11. Israel is likewise based on the military strategy of the Jesuits. Number 12. There is an intimate connection between British South Africa and Israel. Number 13. According to Theodor Herzl's diaries, Herzl states that Israel must be based on Rhodes's plan, as per his letters and correspondence with Cecil Rhodes, Rhodes's secret society also being based on the Jesuits. Number 14. Also ongoing in Africa were numerous other empires trying to likewise rape the native people of their natural resources, including King Leopold of Belgium and the Prussian Habsburg family, as well as Rhodes's diamond cartel, all of which had dealings with the Rothschild family franchise banks. Call it racism, eugenics, or greed, it's all part of the history of the biocratic utopians. Number 15. Among the imperial financiers participating in the diamond cartel in the early 19th century was a gentleman named Augustus Belmont, of the Belmont Stakes horse race fame, who, like many who helped to create the Federal Reserve Bank in 1913, was also part of the American International Corporation, which funded the Soviet Union. So, speaking of psychological warfare and diamonds, the two concepts are intertwined in the story of Osama bin Laden. So just let me read a few titles of the news articles which I have here which connect the funding of quote-unquote Al-Qaeda to diamonds. Al-Qaeda cash tied to diamond trade. Board member of a diamond business is accused of funding bin Laden. Bin Laden is financed by blood diamonds. How cut-price diamonds are traded for weapons. There's plenty more on the internet. I encourage you to search on your own. I just wanted to give you a little peek behind that curtain. This episode contains the full context of two documentaries, the first being The Diamond Empire, a 1995 PBS Frontline documentary from which I sampled a few minutes in Peace Revolution, Episode 21, and I'm offering herein in its entirety. I think you'll find it even more fascinating than the samples because there's so much more to the story which is uniquely found in this documentary. There's also links for all the content in today's episode found at peacerevolution.org, and if there's ever been an episode to dig into, this is the one because it ties everything we've learned thus far together, and learning your way out of this ruse could not only set people free, but it could save you a few thousand or tens of thousands of dollars if you're in the market to get married. I mean, if you're going to get married, you might as well start out on the right foot, and the right foot would be understanding what this is all about. Now, after the PBS documentary I just mentioned, I'm going to include the audio from a documentary called Blood Diamonds, The True Story, which is also in the episode notes, and I'll offer that if you watch all the content in the notes and want more info, that there's plenty of more information and well-educated folks in the Tragedy and Hope online community who are likewise trying to answer these same questions. Being that our mainstream media is controlled by the Council on Foreign Relations and that the CFR is a consequence of Cecil Rhodes' last will and testament, as is De Beers, and that Rhodes and De Beers are in the Rothschild financial network of companies, which in turn owns significant percentages of Reuters and The Economist. Even the publications which service our own Congress, magazines such as Roll Call and Congressional Quarterly, are controlled by the Rothschild financial network, which again is synonymous with De Beers and the Anglo-American Corporation. This is episode 27, Diamonds, the Jewel of Denial, Outgrowing Stockholm Syndrome. Thank you for your support, and thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.
The diamonds and all the associations we have with diamonds, the product of a marketing strategy. It's completely invisible, transparent. If you measure it in terms of how all the myths associated with this advertising campaign have been deeply inculcated in people, it's reached deeply into the popular imagination. This is probably the most successful campaign in history.
Tonight on Frontline.
Diamonds? Aren't they a girl's best friend? Did something change?
Are diamonds what we think they are? Precious and rare.
I wound up discovering it was just the opposite. Everywhere where there's carbon, which is everywhere, you find diamonds.
Frontline examines the cartel that controls the diamond trade. The supply, the price, and the myth.
What makes this cartel different is it's controlled by a single company.
Tonight, the Diamond Empire. Spring of 1992, more than 100 wealthy benefactors from around the world were invited to the Hotel Pierre in New York City to a fundraiser for AIDS research. Elizabeth Taylor, the high priestess of the Mystique of Diamonds, had invited them personally to an auction of fine jewelry that raised more than $500,000. The evening itself was a glittering tribute to the allure of diamonds.
I'm wearing the diamonds because my sweetheart has given them to me, and it means love, and it means forever.
Diamonds? Aren't they a girl's best friend? Did something change?
Diamonds? Diamonds! They're a woman's best friend.
But what we think about diamonds is, in fact, a myth. At the center of that myth is an illusion that diamonds are valuable because they are rare. When writer Edward Epstein set out to investigate the diamond trade, he discovered that diamonds aren't rare at all.
Well, what I learned was that the diamond business wasn't a business of extracting, as I originally expected, something of enormous value, and then simply seeing how much of this object you could get out of the ground and selling it. That was what the business appeared to be when I started my venture. That their real business was restricting what came out of the ground, restricting what was discovered, restricting what got cut, restricting what actually found its way into the retail market, and at the same time, through movies, through advertising, through Hollywood, through the manipulation of perceptions, creating the idea that there was this enormous demand for these shiny little objects that they seemed to have an abundant supply. So I wound up on this voyage of discovery, starting off with the idea that there was this object of great value, and it was just a question of how many could you get out. And I wound up discovering it was just the opposite.
This is the story of how that grand illusion was created, and the story of how one family gained control of the world's diamond trade, and for nearly a century has maintained its hold on an empire that defines the very idea of what diamonds really are. New York is the center of the world's richest diamond jewelry market. It's a $10.8 billion industry. Around 47th Street, there are 25,000 people buying, selling, cutting, polishing, and marketing diamonds. From the most glamorous jewelry to cheap mail order. Very few in the diamond business will talk freely about what they do. There is a great deal of money at stake. There is also a great deal of uncertainty. But that's something top dealers like William Goldberg take in their stride.
It's fascinating. It's amazing. A lot of men that I know that are 10 years younger than I am can't wait to retire, and I can't wait to get here in the morning at 8 o'clock to produce these beautiful works, you know, these beautiful pieces of art from what looks like a pebble on the beach, and then to nurse it through all its stages. And then to finally come up with some of these wonderful things is just a joy.
Goldberg is one of the elite dealers who specialize in rare and precious stones. He has a team of cutters working just off Fifth Avenue. Some of the diamonds they handle will sell to royalty and movie stars for $1 million or more.
This stone took us one of the longest ever, 8 or 9 months. It was the most impossible task. Every time we had new surprises. Nature is very funny when it comes to these things. You know, there were new hidden imperfections which we didn't think existed before, which always seemed to sneak in. We paid in excess of $10 million for this diamond.
Everyone here is very highly skilled technician, and some of them have very specific jobs to do. This man, for example, he's cutting the 85-carat stone. Right now, it's around 36.5 carats, and he's putting the finishing facet on the bottom of the stone. The man behind him, brilliant-eared, put the finishing facets on the top of the stone. These gentlemen are very skilled, and they bring out the final fire in the diamond, the brilliant theory. This stone's going to be a gem. This stone started out 38 carats. It's down to 21 now.
Around 21, yeah.
Harvey's working the stone out. There's a lot of problems. There's a lot of balancing to do. It's coming out nice. You can see the shape. It's going to be a gorgeous marquee. She's shaping the stone using a diamond that's attached to this stick and another diamond that's rotating on the spindle, and he's shaping both at the same time.
They measure diamonds by weight in carats, 5 to the gram. Their value depends on color, clarity, and cut. Flawless stones which are pink, blue, or yellow bring the highest prices. The best can top $100,000 a carat. This stone will sell for $1 million. Diamond is among the hardest known substances, but many carats must often be ground away to cut a rough stone into a traditional marquee or brilliant. The smallest mistake is inordinately expensive. It calls for expert planning from a rough designer.
I will try and find the largest, most pure stone in here.
Matter of fact, this stone will probably end up being three different stones because of the imperfections that I can find. For example, I do see a pear shape, and I do see an emerald cut, and I do see an oval. The most important thing is bringing out the beauty.
De Beers is very proud to continue the Diamond Decade by presenting its program for 1992. Most of the world's rough gem diamonds come through organizations run by the South African company De Beers, known in the United States by its famous advertising slogan, "A diamond is forever." Fewer than 200 diamond merchants qualify for a site, the privilege of buying directly from De Beers. Everyone else must buy in turn from them.
We're site holders. We get a site every 5 weeks from De Beers. If you can come up with a huge sum of money, it would certainly not qualify you to be a site holder. It's rather the man that started 25 years ago with very little, with one or two cutters who has 15 or 20 now here, and who was constantly on the scene buying, and he's the man who means to stay here with his children to follow him. He's the man that qualifies to be a site holder. It's like being admitted to a club.
The headquarters of that club is London. Because it is a virtual monopoly, De Beers cannot operate legally in the United States. All site holders must travel here to buy their rough gems, to a building known only as 17 Charterhouse Street. This is a fortress where 80% of the world's gem diamonds are sorted, graded, and sold. A site holder sends his request for the grade of diamonds he needs, but there are no guarantees. It is De Beers that decides whether or not he gets them. It's a decision that can make or break his business.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
This is your site for October.
Mm-hmm.
In this shoebox is basically the diamonds that they're going to cut that month. And in this mixture of diamonds, there are large diamonds, there are small diamonds, there are colored diamonds. There's what the Beers wants to be on the market. So they distribute to the cutters what is in short supply and withhold from the cutters what is in abundance. So they control the market through this. And there are all sorts of hidden signals in this box. Like if suddenly the site holder, as the person's called, gets many diamonds worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, he'll know he did a special favor, and he's being rewarded for that favor. The other hand, if he finds he's been given a large number of uneconomical diamonds to cut, he'll realize he's fallen out of favor.
Even the world's top dealers are at the mercy of De Beers' central selling organization. William Goldberg usually has special requests alongside the ordinary stones, but even he does not know what to expect.
Right. Here are the regular goods and two boxes of specials.
Thank you.
So we'll see you later. Right.
Thank you
okay.
very much. See you later now. These are greens that come from Botswana. And this is a regular cotton-dried bread-and-butter item. And quite often, these are priced in such a way that there's very little profit to be made on this goods. For whatever reason, at any given moment, they make a policy decision. I've been very angry and cussed a lot and been very upset. But that's how the cookie crumbles. I have no options.
What can you do when that happens?
Just cuss and fret and look forward to the next, that things will change at the next site.
Can you leave all that on the table and say, I'm not interested, I'm not going to make a profit this month? Can you do that?
I told you on the way over here we can leave some of the specials, but we just don't leave the regular goods. Somehow it doesn't work that way.
South Africa is the private estate of the family that controls the diamond empire. These are the Oppenheimers. In two generations, they have built one of the most powerful industrial cartels of the 20th century.
The diamond cartel has lasted for 70 years and shows no sign of weakening. What makes this cartel different is it's controlled by a single company, a single commercial organization, and that's De Beers. And De Beers itself is controlled by another South African company, Anglo-American. Interestingly, Anglo-American is controlled by De Beers. And that interlocking ownership is what allows one small family company, E. Oppenheimer & Sons, who own just a small shareholding in Anglo-American, to control the whole edifice.
Diamond mines of southern Africa are the heart of the diamond empire. Diamonds are crystals of carbon, formed in the heat and pressure 1,200 miles below ground. Where volcanoes have brought them to the surface, they can be dug out of the rock. But many have been washed down rivers to the sea, and these, the alluvial diamonds, can be picked up along the riverbeds and shorelines. Sand and gravel are brushed out of the crevices or scooped in huge quantities out of the hillside. And the rough diamonds are simply sorted out from the rest. There are extinct volcanoes throughout Africa, Asia, Russia, Australia, and America. And they are littered with diamonds. For a commodity which sells at thousands of dollars a carat, the supply seems truly staggering. Diamonds can even be picked out of these shallow waters along the African coast.
You can go to other coastlines and expect to find a few diamonds, but I think you can't build up a scenario that's as optimistic as one can build up for the west coast of South Africa. If you look at what's on the land, and there's three or four raised beaches on land that have produced more than 100 million carats of diamonds. In one of our concessions alone, and it's not one of the bigger concessions, we have mapped 22 beach levels. So you're again going to come out to a number which is of the order of a billion carats or in excess of that.
Because diamonds are so plentiful, it makes De Beers' virtual monopoly an astonishing feat. Its history begins at Kimberley, South Africa in 1871. Until that year, mines had been few and diamonds truly rare, mostly from India and Brazil. But the Kimberley find was huge. Among those who rushed to make their fortunes were two young Englishmen.
Charles Dunnell Rudd, my great-grandfather, and Cecil Rhodes met here in October 1871. They were early in the rush here, and they would have found an anthill, a mining camp, and as Rhodes described it, as silt and fees, as the claim holders dug down into this enormous diamondiferous kimberlite pipe. But their eyes were more directed towards De Beers mine, which is about a mile over the horizon there. And that's where they dealt with the farmer De Beer. And they bought that farm out for £6,000. The thoughts of Rhodes immediately began to concentrate on the amalgamation of all these individual claim holders. And by 1880, he had amalgamated all the claim holders on his mine, the De Beers mine. And that began the amalgamation of all the diamond mines, and the formation of De Beers Consolidated Mines began in 1888.
What Cecil Rhodes had launched was a diamond cartel. It was based on an earlier French scheme to monopolize copper, buying up mines, restricting supply, and raising prices. From its first headquarters in Kimberley, De Beers bought out almost every other large mine in South Africa. But shortly before the First World War, diamonds were found over the border to the north in German Southwest Africa. A young German-born diamond dealer in South Africa went there to investigate. His name was Ernest Oppenheimer.
Ernest Oppenheimer, in 1914, 2 months before the outbreak of war, went there to survey the territory and came back with a report that was mind-boggling and subsequently hidden from the public. The fact that this was the richest diamond field in the history of the world. It was an alluvial field, meaning diamonds were on the surface, you could go pick them up. And in fact, they put what they termed back then natives, black natives, each put a tin can around their neck, and they line them up, and they get on their hands and knees, and they just pink, 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 put the diamonds into the tin cans as they walked on their hands and knees. This is how rich the fields were.
Oppenheimer saw an opportunity and seized it. The German landowners, afraid of expropriation as World War I came to an end, agreed to merge their companies with his. Because both British investors and American financier J.P. Morgan had stock in his venture, Oppenheimer called his company the Anglo-American Corporation. Within a few years, it was clear that he had landed a supply of diamonds to rival even the mines owned by De Beers.
Coming into the 1920s, Ernest Oppenheimer then said to De Beers, who controlled, for the most part, the diamond syndicate, a diamond cartel, he said to them, listen, I am going to flood the world market unless you make me chairman of the company. And in 1929, he was made chairman of De Beers. That is the basis of the Oppenheimer fortune.
Oppenheimer's mine, a private estate three times the size of New Jersey, became an exclusive territory known as the Forbidden Zone. It was the bedrock of the worldwide De Beers diamond empire, which the Oppenheimers began to build.
The true genius of diamonds came through the Oppenheimer family, and came even with Harry Oppenheimer, who's running it today, where they realized that diamonds, as originally conceived, coming from only three or four mines, was wrong. But diamonds existed everywhere in the world. Everywhere where there's carbon, which is everywhere, you find diamonds.
Every famous diamond in the world is represented in this case. They are worth many millions of dollars and trails of blood.
While the public continued to imagine that diamonds were rare and romantic, De Beers was mining enormous quantities. Ernest Oppenheimer saw that more huge finds might force prices to go plummeting downwards. In 1930, a De Beers mining engineer warned, the diamond market is dependent for its smooth function on the maintenance of the illusion in the minds of the general public that the diamond is a rare and valuable stone. A De Beers director agreed, for goodness sake, keep out of the newspapers and parliament the quantity of diamonds that can be produced and put on the market. But as the colonies developed, diamonds began turning up all over Africa. Local people knew where to find them. Eddie Fortune is one of the small claim miners in South Africa.
In the year 1931, in the morning I used to leave Kimberley 3 o'clock by bicycle, and then I used to ride about 31 miles. I had a little shack out on the diggings, and I used to work there. I didn't have trouble selling diamonds because my quality was very good, very big demand. I never found a big diamond. The biggest I found was a 38 carat. But small diamonds and medium sizes, 10s, 12s, 15s, plenty of them.
To keep control, De Beers had to prevent the little mines from putting too many diamonds on the market. The simplest answer was to buy them up.
Certain companies came and they bought up the small diggers, you see. That's how they developed and became a big company. De Beers bought up every...
But alluvial diamonds washed along the riverbanks were much more difficult to control. A film inspired by De Beers in the 1950s portrayed its adventurous young traders setting up buying offices in the jungle.
These young graduates, Oxford graduates, basically a buying office was them, a bunch of porters with food on their head and a cash box on their head, and they'd put a box down the middle of a clearing and they'd start buying diamonds in the local currency. So they'd ship in all these guys to do this, to prevent smuggling.
There is always a competition between the Anglo-American De Beers group and other dealers all over the world for a bigger slice in the world diamond markets. And this did not suit Anglo-American. They wanted the whole trade for themselves.
Fuad Kamil claims he contracted to work as a detective for the cartel in the 1950s and 60s, investigating unlicensed diamond dealing and smuggling from its mines.
Diamonds going out of Sierra Leone and other African diamond markets were going to what Anglo-American described as black markets, that is Antwerp, Amsterdam, Germany, some parts of the United States, and Israel. Now, these people were labeled black markets by Anglo-American, but in their own countries, they were respectable diamond dealers.
To get information, Kamil says he broke the law and even kidnapped people who fell under suspicion.
And those that had diamonds, I took them as prisoners. I interrogated them, got information from them. I kept them as long as I wanted, week to week, some of the months, and released them when I wanted. There was beatings, there was punishments without food. We did everything we could to extort the information from them. There was a stage where no one dared to pass from there, diamonds or no diamonds. So to put it bluntly, we were a terrorist group. That's what it amounts to.
The cartel denies that Kamil worked for either De Beers or Anglo-American and says his accusations are part of a vendetta against them. By the 1950s, the diamond cartel had amassed enormous power, taking control of diamonds at the source, making deals with colonial powers, building its network mine by mine, country by country.
City of radiant joy as the people celebrated Congo Independence Day, a happy occasion full of bright hope.
In the 1960s, the rise of African nationalism presented new challenges to the cartel.
The army of the young republic marches by.
The Congo's first democratically elected leader, Patrice Lumumba, was critical of the colonial mining arrangements, and the local Belgian mining company supported army actions against him.
A new champion.
Mystery begins in the dark and tragic history of the Congo with the...
A coup against the leftist leader was backed by the CIA, and it ended in Lumumba's murder. Mobutu Sese Seko emerged as the dictator of what became Zaire. At first, he too sounded like an African nationalist.
Mobutu had made what seemed like very left-wing radical statements, talking about the colonial exploiters threatening to nationalize all sorts of foreign mining property. And in flies American businessman Maurice Templesman.
Maurice Templesman is an independent diamond dealer and a key intermediary for De Beers.
In a matter of, 10 days, Maurice Templesman holds consultations in Brussels with key officials, meets with the U.S. Embassy in Kinshasa, has consultations with the U.S. State Department, speaks with Mobutu, flies on to go meet with Mr. Oppenheimer of De Beers in South Africa in what, according to what is certainly shown by a number of declassified U.S. State Department documents, to be an attempt to stitch together a relationship between the De Beers Empire and the Mobutu regime. So it's very clear that from the very beginning of the Mobutu regime, Templesman had an important role in, to put it most charitably, advising and guiding Mobutu on how to deal with companies like De Beers.
The Oppenheimers, through Templesman, arranged to have the exclusive supply of diamonds shipped to their offices in London. De Beers has done well on Zaire's diamonds. So has President Mobutu.
For many years, there was a pattern and a practice whereby at regular intervals, Mobutu would send some of his agents to MIBA, the diamond company, to take a look at the most recent production and to select out the best gem quality stones to be flown off, presumably to be sold for his account in Antwerp.
Madame Mobutu also has an eye for diamonds.
This is somebody who's traveling on a diplomatic passport, who just gets whisked right through customs, doesn't get stopped. However, there was one occasion a few years ago when Madame Mobutu went off to Belgium, and she forgot some of her luggage. She sent her secretary, apparently, back to Kinshasa or back to Gbadolite, where Mobutu has his main palace, to get the luggage. The secretary went into customs, didn't show the right kind of documents, was stopped and inspected, and according to the Belgian reports, was found carrying $6 million worth of diamonds. You just need one word. The word is kleptocracy. I'm not the person who invented that word. I wish I did, but it's been used by political scientists to describe governments whose fundamental organizing principle is one of theft.
Mobutu spends huge sums on an army to keep himself in power. He himself is one of the richest men in Africa, while his people are among the poorest.
Zaire has substantial diamond resources as well as other mineral resources, and the revenues generated from those resources could have gone to benefit the Zairean people, and they haven't. The revenues have gone for two purposes. They've either been siphoned off to Mobutu's private bank accounts, or they've been used to provide benefits for foreign governments or foreign companies in the hope that those foreign governments and foreign companies will then be supportive of Mobutu and help him remain in power. I mean, essentially, Mobutu's used the wealth of Zaire for two purposes, to enrich himself and to enrich his foreign supporters.
Despite De Beers' deal with Zaire, some mines in the country are beyond its control. These wildcat miners are fighting over a new claim. The diamonds they find will likely be smuggled out of the country to the few markets the cartel still doesn't control.
You're talking about a country which is certainly one of the two largest diamond producers in the world, where you have this Wild West kind of atmosphere. And looking at it from the outside, I would guess that this is the most difficult relationship over the years that a company like De Beers could have with an African government.
This is an area of intense digging in Kapamba, which is...
In neighboring Angola, regulated diamond mining is a casualty of its devastating civil war. In 1992, wildcat miners there swarmed the diamond-rich dry riverbeds, picking up small fortunes in alluvial diamonds. De Beers has spent an estimated $500 million to keep them from flooding the market and depressing prices.
Stripping and removing the ore.
Each time diamonds are found in an inconvenient place, they begin, the diamond cartel, through intermediaries, through law firms they hire, ways to think, how can we prevent these diamonds from reaching the market? And declaring something a national park, tying things up in litigation, these are just the methods. And there's an infinite number of different methods you could use once you understand what the objective is. The objective is to prevent mines from being developed that are outside their control.
Murfreesboro in southwest Arkansas is the home of America's only diamond mine. At the inauguration, Hillary Clinton wore a diamond found in this mine, which was discovered at the turn of the century. But today, the 100-acre site is mined only by tourists and amateur prospectors. Commercial mining was abandoned here in the 1920s, even though geological surveys showed the mine had great promise. The Justice Department investigated allegations that Ernest Oppenheimer had illegally influenced the closing of the mine to keep its diamonds off the market.
Okay, you better get out of here and see what it can go for.
According to the Justice Department records, Sam Rayburn and other principals of the Arkansas Diamond Corporation met in the office of J.P. Morgan. In attendance of that meeting was Sir Ernest Oppenheimer. As a result of that meeting, and what transpired is unknown, but the mine superintendent was telegrammed to shut the mine down and prepare it for a sustained closure. And as a result, major operations never resumed at the Arkansas Diamond Mining Plant.
The Justice Department was unable to determine whether the mine had been closed illegally or simply because it was unprofitable. But in 1992, a new preliminary geological study indicated the mine may in fact have commercial potential. Like most deposits, it will produce few gemstones, but many smaller stones could be found. They are important because they're used in cutting tools. Industrial diamonds are a multi-billion dollar business in their own right.
Go. Get one, Mr. Free. Get one. It's yellow.
Ooh, light yellow.
Yeah?
Light yellow.
Yeah, like a triangle.
Like a triangle.
Yeah, triangular in shape.
Yeah.
I'm gonna dig a hole right next to right.
Industrial diamonds have a strategic importance because they're used in the making of weapons. After the Arkansas mine closed, it meant that the U.S. military depended, like everyone else, on De Beers in London. When the Second World War started and Britain was faced with Nazi occupation, American strategists wanted to transfer a stockpile of diamonds to this side of the Atlantic, but De Beers hesitated.
The story of De Beers during World War II was truly shameful when they denied the United States, which was an ally of Great Britain and an ally of South Africa in prosecuting the war, when it denied the U.S. free access to required quantities of industrial diamonds.
Defense production in factory and arsenal begins far behind the assembly line.
Apparently fearful that diamond prices would fall if a military stockpile were sold off after the war, the Oppenheimers refused to allow any diamonds out of their control. De Beers claims it was only following the advice of the British government, but the cartel's actions were criticized by the U.S. Justice Department.
Only after complicated arrangements were the Beers insisted on retaining control of those industrial diamonds by placing the supply organization in Canada, was some accommodation reached so that the United States could obtain the quantities of industrial diamonds needed for the war effort on its own behalf and the behalf of its allies.
Meanwhile, however, the Nazis did appear to be getting a steady supply of diamonds, and the Americans were very concerned to find out where they came from. We were able to get documents, secret documents, declassified from the National Archives in Washington that describe the investigation that they mounted into smuggling of diamonds out of the Congo.
A U.S. intelligence officer, Henry Lee Staples, led the American investigation into the smuggling. Before he died, he worked with his son on a memoir of those days.
He had assigned an agent, Teton was his code name, and he had, through whatever means those agents have, determined that the largest source of leakage was the Formini air mine, and the diamonds from the that were leaked from the Formini air mine went to various points in Africa, and from there were by various routes smuggled into Germany. Belgian Red Cross parcels were loaded with illegal diamonds and then sent to Switzerland, and from Switzerland to Belgium, which was of course occupied by the German forces.
The Allies knew that without the Congo stones, Hitler had only an 8-month supply of industrial diamonds. But their hardest task still lay ahead. How could the smuggling be stopped?
The Formini mine is, of course, one of the producers that is signed up in the cartel. Its production is exclusively marketed through the cartel. And indeed, the company which controls the mine, Sibeca, had as one of its principal shareholders, Ernest Oppenheimer.
So that as De Beers, they were faced with the problem of either shutting down their mines entirely so there'd be no leakage, or operating their mines and making profits, and leakage would be inevitable. And as they were a business, they elected to continue in the diamond business, even though it meant inevitably, no matter what they did, and I'm not sure they did that much, but no matter what they did, diamonds would get through. It was impossible to stop diamonds from getting to Hitler, and what the diamond cartel then tried to do is prevent any investigation which would have revealed the very embarrassing reality that diamonds were getting to Hitler.
The investigation was terminated. And the agent, Teton, was convinced the investigation was terminated as a result of influence by the cartel on the British government. We were able to obtain declassified documents in Washington showing his cables complaining that his investigation had been aborted early.
In its extensive investigation of the cartel's behavior during World War II, the Justice Department also concluded De Beers had overcharged the United States for the industrial diamonds it did supply. One U.S. official complained, "This form of profiteering is the more obnoxious because it has been accompanied by pious public professions of sacrifice and patriotic foregoing of profit." And De Beers' wartime advertising did appeal to American patriotism. "Buy our gems," the ad said, "because they pay for mining, which produces the industrial diamonds America needs to win the war."
I was born 3 billion years ago of fire and light.
Cornering the world's supply of diamonds was a stunning achievement. No less extraordinary was the cartel's success in creating a demand for its huge stockpile of diamonds.
Who am I? The eternal gift of love between man and woman.
De Beers campaign, it was probably one of the most successful campaigns. I mean, you measure it in terms of the growth in the market. In the 1930s, they were selling a rather insignificant amount of diamonds in America. By the early 80s, they were selling close to $2 billion worth.
De Beers first targeted American consumers through the movies.
And they opened a Hollywood office. And in the Hollywood office, they would give out diamonds to producers. In return for them, putting the diamonds in the film in a way that was considered very favorable. Now, what was considered favorable was very simple. Surprise. If a woman was brought in on the decision, she might have a lot of ideas of what she wanted. So what they wanted to do is create the idea that the man had to surprise the woman and present her with a diamond.
And now for the important question I wanted to ask you.
Well, it's about time. I'm dying of curiosity.
You know I'm madly in love with you. I want you to marry me, Lily. You're in love with me, too, aren't you?
Well, if I'm not, then I'm afraid I don't know what love is.
Here's your engagement present, darling.
Oh, Jeffrey, it's beautiful.
Well, that's Milo.
Milo?
Yes, he's wondering what's taking us so long.
Wouldn't he be surprised if he knew?
I doubt if he'd be surprised at anything.
Not only are we talking about what is a familiar process today of planting products in films, we've all heard of the product endorsements and that sort of thing, but we're talking about Hollywood in its golden age, where entire movies were created. They identified the biggest stars, actresses of that period, and they never appeared in public without their De Beers diamonds.
Claudette Colbert and Merle Oberon were given special scenes to show off their De Beers diamonds. Diamonds Are Dangerous was conveniently retitled Adventure in Diamonds. But De Beers aimed even higher than Hollywood.
The British royal family was another idea of what, in the American mind, represented the ultimate in how you should behave and how you should behave aristocratically and well. And of course, the British royal family was more than willing to go along because diamonds came from British colonies.
From this, the largest man-made hole in the world, over 100 million pounds worth of diamonds have been recovered. In the De Beers sorting room, 3 million pounds worth of rough diamonds were on view.
The royal family was lobbied heavily and successfully so that the English royalty, Queen Elizabeth, started wearing diamonds, and she basically left all of her other gems off. That's a tremendous coup for a public relations agent to get the royal family to essentially become sales agents.
Caskets made of Kimberley blue ground, embossed with coronets, contained a 6-carat stone for Princess Elizabeth and a 4.5-carat diamond for Princess Margaret.
We must travel back in time 1 billion years to witness its birth.
De Beers Advertising set its diamonds in worlds of glamour and royalty. But its best-known slogan arose out of the fear that sales would be undercut if people began putting second-hand jewelry on the market.
It is rare.
So they had to create the idea that you should never sell a diamond, even though its value would only increase. And secondly, that people should store and hoard these diamonds. So the whole idea that a diamond is forever is really their desperate hope that people will hold diamonds forever.
It is love. And its only promise is forever.
We're planning to attract your customer by building on our rites of passage program.
In its message to dealers, De Beers reveals its key marketing strategy is to convince consumers to buy diamonds for every romantic milestone.
Let's start with your bread and butter, the support behind the rites of passage, the diamond engagement ring, Diamond Anniversary Band, and the 25th Anniversary Diamond. Our goal is to make diamonds a cultural imperative for all these important occasions in a woman's life. That's why we are continuing to support these segments, so that newer products like the Diamond Anniversary Band and the 25th Anniversary Diamond will become as obligatory as the Diamond Engagement Ring, bringing your customers back again and again.
Nobody's aware that diamonds and all the associations we have with diamonds is a product of a marketing strategy. It's completely invisible, transparent. If you measure it in terms of how all the myths associated with this advertising campaign have been deeply inculcated in people, it's reached deeply into the popular imagination, this is probably the most successful campaign in history.
That's what we're here for, to respond to your requests and to help you sell more diamonds.
De Beers' control of African stones and American consumers made it one of the most successful cartels in history. But it would face new challenges as diamond mines were discovered around the world. In the 1950s, diamonds were found in a place where neither South Africans nor Americans could easily do business, in Siberia.
In 1947, geological prospecting parties entered the Yakutian taiga. Would this daring hypothesis be confirmed or not? The answer was given after 7 years of persevering search. Yakut diamonds.
If the Russians had dumped their diamonds on the market, it might have put an end to the cartel. But in 1957, while De Beers was very publicly opening a new building for its central selling organization in London, the Oppenheimers were very privately beginning to do business with the Russians.
Workers gaze with pride at what they have accomplished.
Russian diamond production was a problem for the cartel. Russia, the communists, were anathema to the South Africans. Equally, the South Africans were an anathema to the Russians. This created a problem for the cartel because they couldn't be seen to be dealing with the Soviet diamond production. The cartel is an operation that's well used to cloaking their business operations in mystery. They simply set up a separate operation owned by a UK merchant bank across the street from their offices. The diamonds would appear to have found their way into the central selling organization without a problem.
By the 1980s, Russian diamonds were pouring quietly through London into the market. Harry Oppenheimer's son-in-law was seen at the Bolshoi. Officially coming from South Africa, he could not even have had an entry visa.
Thank you very much.
What you were doing in Moscow?
No. Just where you're being thoroughly unreasonable. You spoke to me politely, and I said, no, I have nothing to say. Thank you very much.
Do you not think it's interesting,
then? I have nothing to say.
Were you just there for the ballet?
The other interesting feature of the Russian diamond production was that there was an extraordinarily large proportion of medium-sized stones in the quarter to half carat size. De Beers then came up with perhaps one of the great new product inventions in jewelry history, the Eternity Ring, a ring that was designed to use up this excessive production of low-sized stones. And it is perhaps amusing to think that at the height of the Cold War, the Eternity Ring that was being so successfully marketed in America was filled with stones from Siberia.
As the Soviet Union became an important source of small stones, the problem for the diamond industry became finding cutters willing to work for low enough wages to make these stones profitable. India soon developed into the world's greatest cutting center. There are 750,000 cutters in workshops around Surat. Perhaps 100,000 of them, children under 13. They place 58 exact cuts on a diamond less than half a carat, smaller than a broken pencil lead. Many children work a 12-hour day, 6 days a week. They earn 4 cents a stone.
The Indian diamonds have made it possible to make low-priced jewelry. It looks like a lot. It's called more flash for less cash. This is the expression that's used in the industry, and this seems to be the trend. We perceive popular retail price points to top out at about $500. This is what most of our customers are demanding now, and starting as low as $75, $80. We just got in some new samples today. These are examples. Here's a ring that sells for $70. There's $2 worth of diamond in this ring. But the fact that we can market it as an article with a genuine diamond makes it more saleable. Here's another ring. This is a $90 ring. There's a dollar diamond in here. It's a white finish that makes it appear like diamonds. There's only one diamond in the center.
When diamonds were discovered in 1979 at Australia's Ashton mine, the cartel machinery mobilized once again to bring this new find, the largest ever, into the fold. Until then, the cartel had co-opted diamond sources largely in Russia and African countries. Could they repeat the success in a country that was modern and democratic?
The Ashton project certainly had huge reserves, which, if it had gone into independent hands, would certainly have challenged De Beers' monopoly. Now, I know that the Indian government had made representations to Australia to take over the marketing. I myself met with one independent diamond trader who was visiting from London, and he was also putting in his bid and trying to persuade the Australian government that, in fact, as I said, there were enormous benefits for Australia, and it was not in the interest to further reinforce a monopoly.
But De Beers pressured Australia by threatening to reduce diamond prices in the categories of stones the new mine would produce. At the same time, the Oppenheimers bought stock in key Australian companies. De Beers chairman, Harry Oppenheimer, flew in to cement alliances, and the cartel began to lobby the government and mold public opinion.
Many Australian journalists were invited to South Africa, sponsored by De Beers, to go on, tours which were meant to promote De Beers' image and soften the impact of De Beers' penetration into the Australian economy. And soon after those tours took place, it became quite evident in the Australian media, mainly through the newspapers, that there was a CSO approach being adopted by the media. So I think De Beers' strategy worked quite well in that they'd softened up the Australian media, and the media reciprocated by promoting very favorable stories to the De Beers takeover of the Ashton project.
After a major political battle, the cartel scored a crucial victory. The bulk of Australia's output, mainly industrial grade and small gemstones, would flow through the cartel's central selling organization in London. A small number of rare gemstones, known as the Argyle Pinks, were Australia's own to market independently.
They produce a variety of colours, which is very unique to this mine, and out of the 36 million carats come some of the rarest diamonds in the world. The extraordinary thing is nature's thrown up these freaks, which are just unique and special, and you know, they're something that we're all madly trying to get hold of, can't get enough of. If you look at this small, very intense pink from Argyle, and it's only, I think it's about 18 points, and then you compare it against this two-carater from Argyle, the two-carater is worth about $22,000. Now, if we could superimpose that color on that small pink into that two-carater, that two-carater would be worth at least $1 million in today's market. Now, Argyle only gets maybe 3, 4, 5 of those stones a year maximum out of, remember, 35, 36 million carats of diamonds.
the De Beers operation is essentially the control of the production of diamonds. They control the chain of supply of diamonds, and that's the way in which they control the diamond market. If somebody were to try to go around the cartel, the concern that they would have to have is how long it would last. Because, of course, De Beers in the past has been very successful at bringing all the producers into the cartel.
Today, a century after it began, the diamond cartel still controls the production, the marketing, and the pricing of rough diamonds around the world. But that world is changing, and there are new threats to the Oppenheimers' dominance of the diamond trade. In its largest market, the United States, the cartel cannot operate openly. Its monopolistic control of the worldwide diamond trade violates U.S. antitrust laws.
Section 1 of the Sherman Act says every contract, combination, or conspiracy in restraint of trade is hereby declared to be unlawful. The Sherman Act, in effect, says that as long as you have enough competitors and as long as they act independently, the public interest will be protected. But once you have conspiracy among them, the public interest will be undermined.
Four times since the 1940s, the U.S. government has investigated De Beers and its associates under the Sherman Act. But bringing a South African company to American justice has proved almost impossible.
We hired a South African solicitor to serve a notice on De Beers in South Africa. It took a while to get any South African lawyer who was willing to even serve the paper. One agreed, and he wrote us an affidavit of his experience, which was that he took the court paper and took it to De Beers, and that the De Beers representative took the paper, ripped it into small shreds, threw it on the ground, and stamped on it, and then basically threw him out.
And the cartel has successfully kept its executives beyond the reach of American justice.
I'll tell you, when the red flag goes up from their lawyers, these guys are not allowed to set foot in the U.S. Name goes on a computer, beep, 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 beep. I'm sorry, sir, we have to subpoena you. And under a subpoena in the U.S., you have no rights. You have to tell everything. You cannot lie. You cannot plead irrelevance. It's for them to decide what's irrelevant. It's not like a court where you have certain rights. And so on occasion, when I interview these guys, they always tell me, Al, the best exit from the U.S. is always Chicago's O'Hare Airport. That's where we're ordered to get to immediately because they're the laxest in terms of immigration. We can get right out of the country.
While a subsidiary once paid a nominal fine, De Beers has avoided prosecution in the U.S. Not only has the Justice Department found it impossible to touch the Oppenheimers in South Africa, it has been unable to penetrate the cartel's respectable London operation.
It's well known that the British government has historically been vigorously opposed to any U.S. enforcement of antitrust laws against activity that takes place in Great Britain. And as we know, a great deal of what De Beers does takes place in Great Britain.
Now, the United States has been extending its reach outside its boundaries, sort of as we have done by seizing General Noriega in Panama and prosecuting him with American laws. We've been doing this more and more. And I don't think it's inconceivable that at a certain point, the fiction that the American diamond industry, the stores that sell and the merchants that sell the diamonds and sell most of the diamonds in the world and sell them to American customers, the idea that De Beers is not acting in cahoots with them in America by putting rules on them in London, that I think that fairly soon the Department of Justice will come to the idea that even though the diamonds are handed over in London, They hand it over with rules and stipulations which mean that De Beers is operating in the American market. And De Beers could be tried if they came to that decision, which I think is eventually they will.
And the Justice Department may now be closing in on one alleged De Beers operation. Synthetic diamonds were developed long ago for use in industry. De Beers has its own factory in Ireland. Its biggest international rival is General Electric. The Sherman Act strictly limits how two giants like De Beers and GE can work together. But the relationship they developed in the 80s has been brought into question.
GE developed this process for making a pure C12 diamond. And I was widely quoted in the international press that this would be a several hundred million dollar opportunity for us. But to do it, we had to grow gemstones. And we started a process for growing gemstones. And after a short period of time, we were making gemstones, 3 to 4 carats, flawless ease, which is a very high grade of diamonds. And because we were growing them synthetically, we had a number of advantages. We could make them all the same size, and you could color them. You can make them blues. So it's very easy to grow a 3 or 4 carat blue diamond. Once having established our technical capability to do that, we started to look at the $4 billion gemstone market.
But as soon as Ed Russell began to edge beyond industrials and towards the valuable market for gems, he ran into resistance within GE from his own immediate boss.
Glenn Heiner, who was at this time meeting with De Beers on a regular basis and having phone calls and what have you, simply killed the project and said, we will not compete with De Beers, period.
Soon afterwards, Ed Russell was fired. He's now suing GE for wrongful discharge and alleging it is involved in a cartel with De Beers.
What happened after I was terminated, a price increase on all industrial diamond products was put in by GE and De Beers. They followed each other at identical prices that were implemented.
In his lawsuit, Russell claims GE fired him for blowing the whistle about its dealings with De Beers. The Justice Department has investigated, and for more than a year, a federal grand jury has been hearing evidence on the price-fixing allegation. General Electric denies any wrongdoing, saying it met with De Beers only to discuss exchanging technology, and fired Russell because of his poor job performance. Back in South Africa, still the center of its power, the diamond cartel is also dealing with a political earthquake. What impact will the dismantling of apartheid have on the De Beers monopoly? Harry Oppenheimer, the man who ran the cartel for 25 years, has been a longtime critic of the South African government's apartheid policy.
More peaceful conditions in South Africa as a whole. We have to believe, and by our practice demonstrate, that the pursuit of business efficiency and the search for a free and just society are not contradictory objectives, but in fact two aspects of the same thing, two sides of one coin.
He himself has publicly come out against apartheid on many occasions and continues to do so. I think the problem is, and this is where he's been criticized in the past, the problem is that the mining houses that he controlled made use of the migrant labor system. They made use of the compound system. They made use of the pass laws. They made use of all the institutions which in fact created apartheid. So in that sense, people questioned why, on the one hand, does this man oppose apartheid, but on the other hand, he makes money out of apartheid.
High up near Bulawayo, visited by the...
100 years ago, De Beers' founder, Cecil Rhodes, laid the groundwork for the cartel's success in South Africa.
Ironically, the famous empire builder, in his commercial activities, turning the early diamond rush into a vast industry, sowed the seeds of apartheid.
Particularly after they discovered the diamond mines, what they were looking for was to try and create a workforce for those mines. And the problem was that they needed unskilled workers, but the problem was that most of the available potential labor force were black people living on the land. And in order to get them into the mines, they had to find ways of forcing them off the land. And one of the mechanisms they adopted was passing various taxes, such as poll tax, hut tax, even a dog tax, which forced people living on the land to pay cash to the government. And they didn't have cash because they were not part of a cash economy. So they therefore had to go into the mines to earn the money to pay the taxes.
In order to pay their taxes, many Africans had to leave their families behind and walk hundreds of miles to work in the mines. Once inside, a miner could not leave until his contract was over. De Beers' closed compounds became the model for the entire mining industry in South Africa. By the 1960s, these compounds had expanded into enormous complexes housing thousands of men.
When I arrived in the mine in 1968, I was quite appalled by the conditions for the migrant laborers. The working hours were long, it was a 60-hour week. The conditions under which they worked, they were out in the open, very little protection against the cold and the wind. They weren't given much to eat. They were given half a loaf of brown bread and a flask of cold tea to last them throughout that 10-hour shift. Conditions in the hostels were not much better. There were no decent dining facilities. They had to eat in their rooms out of aluminium buckets. There was no real privacy. The hostels themselves were not very nice places to be in, single-sex hostels, 20 people to a room in some instances.
Many black miners still live in segregated compounds away from their families. In a country in which it is illegal to pick a diamond up off the ground and keep it, a miners' union claims workers can be dismissed merely on suspicion of stealing diamonds. But today, De Beers says everybody gets a proper hearing.
Any employee who could actually buy a new car has been investigated, and people were dismissed summarily because they were suspected of dealing with diamonds. How can they buy a new car? So people were dismissed without a hearing, not a proper hearing, without an inquiry whatsoever. People were dismissed, and the reasons given, which was there on paper, was security reason. And that cannot be followed up in terms of an appeal and so on. And our people were very afraid to take the BS at a higher level, because in our country, the BS is an empire.
Ironically, the revulsion of the world to the brutality of the apartheid government contributed to the growth of the Oppenheimer's power inside South Africa.
When in 1960 we had the Sharpeville massacre, a number of international companies in South Africa decided to get out of the country, and many investors also withdrew, overseas investors withdrew their investments from the stock exchange. Companies like Anglo American and other large corporations then bought up the shares in the stock exchange in order to prevent the exchange from collapsing, and which would have generated a financial crisis. Instead of possibly allowing a financial crisis, which would have then forced the government into more difficulties and perhaps brought about an earlier end to apartheid, they actively supported the economy and therefore gave the government a base from which it could protect itself.
Companies in the Oppenheimer Empire include breweries, paper mills, chemicals, farms, and businesses of every description. Today, the empire's interests represent up to 40% of the total value of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange.
And now I'm going to press the button and let us see what happens.
But as his empire grew, Harry Oppenheimer tried to separate his reputation from that of the pariah government in South Africa. This 1979 De Beers film showed Oppenheimer the reformer.
In a decision taken by the De Beers company to move away, so far as it was possible to do so, and as quickly as possible, from the system of migrant labor. We are moving away from that system, and we are making a great effort, and I think a very successful effort, to replace it by a system by which the workers in the mines will be permanently resident and will not be going backwards and forwards between the mines and our homes in quite different parts of the country.
In spite of Oppenheimer's reforms, his early support of black labor unions and other liberal causes, he says he's been hesitant to use his business clout to influence the government's policies. He explained why in an interview with South African television.
I think one's got to put this in two ways. I mean, there's my own position as an individual. I've never believed that the government's policies are right, particularly in the racial field. But I've also would think it quite wrong in my capacity as chairman of the Anglo-American Corporation to use that position in order to try to press the government into views which I believe in, which that they don't believe in.
In a few months, Nelson Mandela will lead the black majority to power in South Africa. But as the election nears, the ANC is sending strong signals that it needs the support of the white business community. So what will the new South Africa mean for the Diamond Empire?
Until there is legislation preventing the existence of these cartels, or until there's a major crack in the market, the cartel will survive. I do know that the ANC is thinking about antitrust legislation in South Africa for the future. But whether they would include a company like De Beers in that or not is an open question, simply because De Beers is too powerful. If they were to include De Beers in that and De Beers were to stop producing diamonds, it would be very serious for our economy.
Another challenge to the cartel's power is the political unrest in the former Soviet Union. Boris Yeltsin is unhappy with the terms of a 5-year De Beers contract signed by Mikhail Gorbachev. In 1992, the Russian parliament investigated an allegation that De Beers had undervalued Russian diamonds.
I think it's difficult to estimate how much they lost actually with De Beers. It could have very, very well been possible that if they would have sold the goods to somebody else, that they would have made also only the same price. There just wasn't anybody else who could get it. That's the difference. And that's where we go back to the monopoly.
Evgeny Bychkov oversees the country's diamond stockpiles.
It's in Russia's interests to get a good price and sell the goods in order to cover the expenses of mining and make a profit. And we're going to negotiate with De Beers about reducing this quota. Let us hope that a mutually beneficial solution will be found. Let us not approach these issues from the point of view of what if they say no.
Russia has more leverage than other producers. Its diamond production is greater than South Africa's. Its deposits in the ground are immense, and its stockpiles may exceed even those of De Beers. Russia's instability and desperate need for hard currency are potentially devastating to De Beers. These millions of carats of diamonds, if suddenly dumped onto the market, could destroy the cartel. 2 years ago, the Oppenheimers opened an office in Moscow. They seemed to spare no effort to cement friendships and influence people in government circles, trying to keep the Russians inside the cartel.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm extremely grateful to Julian Ogilvie.
Despite all the forces that threatened the Diamond Empire, the cartel seems to approach these latest challenges with a serene confidence.
I think you carry on with where you find yourself in life. I chose my father with discretion, and I found myself in a certain position, and I mean, like the prayer book says, I have sought to do my duty in the station which it pleased the Lord to call me.
After a century of maneuvers to control the supply and price of diamonds, the cartel's greatest accomplishment may be that it has transformed the illusion that diamonds are valuable into a hard reality. And the future of the Diamond Empire may now rest with the complicity of millions of consumers, all invested in the myth that diamonds will be valuable forever.
Give her what her heart wants most, a diamond.
People feel that a diamond is only desirable because it's a symbol of great sacrifice. A man will make a great sacrifice to a woman and take a portion of his wealth and buy a diamond.
I know. You shouldn't have waited 10 years for this.
If a diamond costs relatively nothing, say $5 or $10, what a breakfast cost, it would have the same aesthetic value, but not the same a value in the imagination that it has. So people like spending a lot of money on diamonds.
That I waited 25 years to give you this.
The 25th anniversary diamond, a brilliant celebration of a loving marriage.
I've got goosebumps.
So, like all deception, the person who's deceived plays a part in the deception as well as the deceiver. It's not a one-person act. It's two people, the deceiver and the deceived, act in collaboration.
More profound than words. Diamonds.
In 2007, the Leonardo DiCaprio movie Blood Diamond revealed the dark side of the world's most sought-after gem. The film is set in Sierra Leone, one of the poorest nations on Earth. The average income of its people is little more than £100 a year. Yet, beneath its soil lies a treasure trove of diamonds.
Sierra Leonean diamonds are legendary for their value and their beauty. It's the size, the color, the refractive nature of the stone, all those qualities that the diamond specialists know and love.
Diamonds should have made Sierra Leone a paradise. Instead, they've made it a hell. From 1991 to 2001, a brutal war raged between the government and a rebel group called the RUF, the Revolutionary United Front. A war funded in part by diamonds.
They said they were fighting for democracy, but they fought against civilians. And they used diamonds to fuel the whole thing. They used diamonds to get the guns to fight the war.
The country and its people still bear the scars of 10 years of diamond-fueled warfare.
That very day, where they chopped me to hand.
That very day when they chopped my hands off, I didn't expect to leave. I didn't believe I would be able to sit down and talk to you as I do now. I knew I was finished.
During the war, Ibrahim Fofana worked in one of the many mines in eastern Sierra Leone, pulling rough diamonds from the ground. In April 1998, the RUF attacked his village.
The rebel there wouldn't come inside the town.
When they came to town, they were in full combat uniform. They had weapons, RPGs.
Rebels confronted his neighbor.
Now, they didn't know that soldiers say...
One of the soldiers asked him for diamonds, and he told him he had no diamonds.
After me out, to the next house, make
the soldier followed him out, shot and killed him.
A different fate awaited Ibrahim.
I do all kind of cry, holla.
I yelled and screamed. The rebels were laughing at me. They told me to stretch my arms out, but I said that was not going to happen. They used their guns and hit me all over my body, and that weakened me. This hand, they laid it out on the mortar and chopped it off. They laid the other one out and chopped it off too.
In Sierra Leone, more than 10,000 people suffered a similar fate. Amputation became the trademark atrocity of the RUF.
They committed every war crime in the Geneva Conventions and then invented one of their own, intentional mutilation of non-combatant civilians. And the whole purpose of it was to serve a military strategy to induce population flow away from the areas that the RUF wanted under its control. And of course, that was just the diamond mines.
As the people of Sierra Leone suffered the horrors of civil war, diamonds mined illegally by the rebels flowed freely into the world diamond market.
Our estimates are that 10 to 15%, possibly even higher, of the world diamond trade was blood diamonds.
Blood diamonds, mined in the 1990s, still grace the hands and necks of unsuspecting customers all over the world.
A conflict diamond doesn't come with a little tag on it that says conflict diamond. I am from a war zone. It doesn't have a little sort of like skull and crossbones nicked in the side.
The modern story of how diamonds are brought to the market is bound up with one company that took a stone and transformed it into a multi-billion pound industry. In Sierra Leone in the 1990s, RUF rebels used revenue from diamonds to fund a brutal civil war.
So I've been there as I picked this guava. Now I see
I was picking guava from a tree when I saw them. Some wearing red, some had red ribbons, 10 of them. They asked me why I was frightened. They literally fell on me and sexually assaulted me.
RUF soldiers gave themselves gruesome nicknames, such as Bloodmaster, Wicked to Women, and the Killer.
They don't go surround the village and don't capture some of you.
They surrounded the village and captured about 55 of us. They put us together and then called upon a boy known as the Killer. They decided to sacrifice someone. They brought a lady from the Limba ethnic group, and she was killed.
Diamonds also funded two other brutal civil wars in Africa during the 1990s, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Angola. And it was in Angola that the horrors of blood diamonds first came to the world's attention.
It's got everything, offshore oil, it's got diamonds, it has all kinds of resources, and it's just a sad, dismal tale of human greed and of the most revolting conditions of exploitation.
From the mid-70s to the mid-90s, a bitter civil war had raged between government troops and rebel forces, known as UNITA. While the government relied on Angola's oil revenues, the rebels turned to diamonds.
At the beginning of the 90s, they needed money for arms, and so they strategically decided to take over the diamond mines in northern Angola.
By 1992, the rebels controlled nearly 70% of Angola's diamond mines.
The war was funded in one part by the sale of diamonds extracted by people often in conditions of enslavement.
And they had little trouble finding buyers for their illicit stones.
UNITA had a very sophisticated sales system in place. Diamond dealers from all over the diamond dealing world would come to UNITA. They would even form joint mining partnerships. Those diamonds went straight into the market in Antwerp, and they got an enormous amount of money for them. $3.7 billion worth of diamonds from Angola went through UNITA's hands during the 1990s.
Often, deals were done without cash even changing hands.
Arms dealers would fly in and would directly negotiate arms for diamonds. They would bring their diamond evaluator with them, and there would be no cash. This was simply a diamond for arms transaction.
Somebody would fly a tank down to Angola in a Russian IL-76 and land it on a little bush strip that couldn't be picked up by satellite at night. Down goes the back, up into the light goes a guy with a sack of diamonds. Some little guy sits down with a table, paws through the sample, decides what they're worth, off goes the tank.
Illegal diamond revenue sustained UNITA's vicious war machine. For the people of Angola, the horror seemed to have no end.
Close to 1 million people lost their lives in the conflict in Angola unnecessarily.
The war sparked an investigation by Global Witness, a small London-based pressure group focusing on human rights abuses and environmental issues.
Angolan diamonds are some of the best diamonds in the world. 80% of Angola's diamonds are gem quality. These are the diamonds that everybody wants. And that was one of the main problems for Angola and one of the blessings for UNITA.
In 1998, Global Witness published an expose on conflict diamonds entitled A Rough Trade.
The reaction that Global Witness received from the publication of our report in 98 was explosive. Nobody understood what was really happening, the impact of these diamonds being sold so openly, so easily, in exchange for millions of dollars. Really, for us, it was horrific that consumers were basically funding the war in Angola, and we felt that was unacceptable.
What Global Witness did was to expose this diamond ring, this act of love in the West, as being intrinsically linked to a bloody conflict somewhere in Africa. In fact, far from expressing love, it's actually joined up to a chain of commercial transactions that started with someone getting killed or maimed through an act of war.
The report's greatest criticism was leveled at industry giant, De Beers. De Beers had dominated the market in African diamonds for 100 years. Their philosophy was simple. Control diamond supply, and you control prices.
We have an idea that diamonds are rare, but they're not. What created the value in diamonds is withholding the supply, making sure that the supply is regulated and there's never a flood of diamonds on the market. That's one thing that De Beers did right from the beginning.
With supply under their control, De Beers, under the inspired leadership of their chairman, Ernest Oppenheimer, launched a brilliant ad campaign in 1948, designed to increase demand.
His genius was in coming up with the advertising campaign that made a diamond synonymous with human love, and in particular, the right of marriage and engagement. Because he rightly concluded that he could get people to pay quite a bit to buy a diamond in order to pledge their love.
But the blood diamond scandal that Global Witness unleashed threatened the De Beers business as never before.
De Beers was very prominent in buying Angolan diamonds and also diamonds that came from UNITA. From 1992 to 1997, in every annual report, they talked about their outside buying power, how strong they were on the market to buy up these diamonds that were flooding onto the market that would have threatened the price stability of the diamond trade.
De Beers defends its purchase of Angolan diamonds.
Well, first of all, De Beers, to make it absolutely clear, has never bought conflict diamonds. During the 90s, we were working in partnership with the official government in Luanda, purchasing diamonds, exporting, paying revenues, etc.
They dispute the idea that blood or conflict diamonds even existed before 1998.
Up until the point of sanctions being imposed, there was, by definition, no conflict diamonds in that country.
The diamond industry likes to think that conflict diamonds only started in 1999, when in fact it was going on way before that.
When it was recognized that the rebels in Angola were no longer going to participate in any significant way in building peace in that country, the United Nations imposed sanctions, and De Beers immediately, swiftly and effectively started working with the United Nations to ensure that those sanctions were fully implemented.
In October 1999, De Beers took decisive action and announced the closure of their Angolan offices. But the blood diamond story wasn't over. 2,000 miles away, the war in Sierra Leone stood on the verge of new horrors. Diamonds have played a central part in Sierra Leone's history for centuries. Under British rule, and for the first few years after independence, diamonds had brought prosperity to this tiny nation.
When Sierra Leone got independence in 1961, the prospects looked pretty good. It had a fairly good infrastructure. There was a railroad, there was a network of highways, there were schools, there was a university. But many of the institutions were very, very fragile.
As time passed, government corruption grew.
Gradually, the diamond industry was nationalized. The government brought in all kinds of shady characters. They brought in American mafia. There were just an incredible range of very, very bad people involved in the diamond business. Official diamond exports went from, you know, $200-300 million a year down to almost nothing. Pretty soon you had a state in free fall. A lot of young students, university students, were radicalized during this time and by this experience, and they formed a kind of an opposition that fed into the early days of the rebel movement that started up in the early 90s.
One of the rebel leaders was former army corporal Fode Sanko.
Fode Sanko, I know him very well. It's like a chameleon. Chameleon in the sense, a chameleon can take any color. The way he sees you is the way he appears to you. At times he looks nice, simple, loving. But Fode Sanko is very difficult to accept, and Fode Sanko cannot keep to his words. Today he is black, tomorrow he is white.
No master!
No slave.
No slave!
No master.
Nothing. You have to do it for yourself. Is that fair?
Under Sanko's leadership, the RUF recruited and trained its army.
Many people believe that the RUF actually had a genuine cause, a grievance against the government. The so-called legitimate government of Sierra Leone squandered the diamond revenues. They stole the money that should have gone for development. No money was going back to build schools or hospitals. The infrastructure in Sierra Leone was atrocious.
When they launched their civil war, their first objective was the lucrative diamond district of Kono. Sanko's rebel army brutalized all who stood in their way.
Why they were the fashion diamond?
The rebels insisted on having diamonds. When they discovered diamonds in Kono, they realized it was their only source of outside support. If those rebels were right here, doing farming, they would not have the outside support and the war would have been over a long time ago. I would not have had my hands amputated.
By November 1993, more than 370,000 terrified citizens had become refugees. The RUF had achieved one of its objectives, to drive away much of the population from the diamond fields.
The RUF wanted to take Kono or the diamond areas because of the resources.
The rebels had captured the mines, but now they needed miners. A new campaign of terror was launched to turn Sierra Leone's diamond mines into slave labor camps. Before the start of the Civil War, Usman Conte was a typical teenager. But when he was just 17, he was abducted during a rebel raid on his hometown.
We were in a motor car, in a truck, more than 100 of us. I thought that since we had been captured, they were going to kill us. They brought us here to suffer. They told us to mine.
Thousands were forced to work at gunpoint, mining the diamonds that would support the RUF's war.
It was day and night, day and night. They would kill us if you tried to rest. You would have to go to the toilet right there where we worked.
Physical exhaustion was very commonplace. In fact, it was a tactic of the RUF to wear out the miners so that they wouldn't be inclined to run away or flee.
There wasn't enough food. We were slaves. If you decided to leave to find something to eat and you were caught, you would be killed.
Rebels hovered over each captive, guarding against escape or theft.
If they suspect you having a diamond, pray to God at that time that when they say, where is the diamond, you say, here is it. If not, you lose your life.
So that time they opened the hook.
Sometime when we were working, someone took a diamond and refused to give it back. They asked him for it, but he denied taking it. So he was interrogated. And when he insisted not taking it, he was shot and killed. He would now have to give it to them in the hereafter.
Off the sweat of enslaved miners, rough diamonds poured in from the fields and were whisked out of the country along smuggling routes established decades before.
The same routes had already been established to smuggle arms, to smuggle cocaine around West Africa. They could get drugs, arms, or diamonds on any plane of their choice, any ship of their choice, and they were extremely resourceful and innovative in the ways they chose to do that.
In return for the diamonds, we need arms and ammunition. Arms like AK-47 rifles, GPMG, that is general purpose machine guns, RPGs.
FN long-barreled rifles, surface-to-air missiles, helicopters, helicopter parts. Ammunition was often delivered in million-block orders.
RUF control of Sierra Leone's diamonds served another strategic purpose.
When we get these rich areas, that is the resources area, then the government will collapse economically. It will not be able to finance its military.
With the army starved of equipment and pay, many disgruntled soldiers turned against their own people.
The soldiers were not really able to effectively prosecute the war. And a lot of them became sobels, that is, soldier come rebels. And so that's complicated the whole situation in the war front.
As anarchy reigned in Sierra Leone, the country's children would soon be drawn into the conflict. Some were killed. Others did the killing. The conflict in Sierra Leone took on a horrifying new aspect when the RUF began kidnapping children.
They would capture the children in a specific area and then drug the children, brainwash the children. They'd show them Rambo movies one after the other, fill them full of cocaine and marijuana and cheap liquor and say, your parents have betrayed you, they betrayed the country, they're your enemy, you've got to go and kill your parents.
During the war, nearly 20,000 boys and girls aged mostly between 8 and 15 were turned into sex slaves or killing machines.
Nine then go with me
They took me away and I was sexually abused. They gave me a gun, but I didn't know how to use it, so I just held on to it.
Lovette Freeman was just 14 when she was abducted by the RUF.
I did what they wanted me to do, because if I refused, they would threaten me with a knife. I did bad things. We went to a house to loot and I was in front. They all waited in the back while I knocked on the door. A woman opened the door and I pointed the gun at her. She staggered back and we entered the house. I took the woman's baby from the house and took her away with me. I abducted her. She later died and I felt so sorry for that baby.
By the end of 1994, with much of Sierra Leone in chaos, the government hired a South African mercenary army called Executive Outcomes to restore order. The soldiers for hire were promised diamonds as pay.
Executive Outcomes had an effective air power, which they used to their advantage in the diamond area. They had one big aim, to clear those areas of rebels, because their whole pay depended on that.
In just 1 month, Executive Outcomes drove the RUF out of most of the diamond-rich East. The resulting peace brought elections in 1996, but the RUF refused to participate. Former United Nations official Ahmad Tidjane Kabah was elected president.
Ahmad Tidjane Kabah campaigned in a very simple way. They would help end the war and return this country to normalcy.
Enough is enough. We should really try and stop the decline of our country.
But at the urging of the UN, Kabah terminated the contract of Executive Outcomes. With no military force to stop them, the RUF rose up again.
The RUF said that it was fighting against military rule and they were for democracy and they wanted peace and development. But when the military government left power and there was an elected government, they kept on fighting.
And to punish those who voted for President Kabah, the RUF exacted horrific revenge on the people of Sierra Leone.
They called us Tidjane Kabah supporters. They said, today would be the last day you meddle in politics. They ordered me to stretch my hand. I pleaded with them in the name of God. I told them, right now, I have my children, my husband is unemployed, and I am the head of my family. They mocked me, saying, stretch your hand and touch God.
Move your hand from the war. Take off your hands out of the war. That was the meaning of that chopping of hands.
Kumba Mbindi fled her village with her husband and young son when it was attacked by rebels.
We left there and moved to Tumbudu. When we got there, they were still chasing us, so we stayed in the woods. At that time, I was 4 months pregnant.
But the RUF caught up with them. Kumba's husband was dragged into the jungle, and three rebels accosted her.
Before the member, I don't know, put the clothes off. I pleaded with him, but he started undressing me. I was stripped and I fell. I continued to plead that I was pregnant, but he responded by saying that wasn't his doing. He went into the farmhouse, came out with a stick.
You can't be seen now, that farm moving now.
I started bleeding. He was going to split my stomach open and remove my baby.
Then Kumba's husband emerged from the jungle.
Blood was spraying from his wrist area. He yelled, they cut my hands off. So I kept thinking, they cut my husband's hands off, they mutilated me. I asked him why they cut his hands off. He said they told him they did it because he voted for Tijan-Kaba, that it was lessened so they wouldn't do that anymore.
In 1996, the war entered its sixth year. Illicit diamonds had helped sustain a conflict that might otherwise have ended quickly.
The amount of money that the IUF made from the diamonds in Sierra Leone is between $50 to $125 million per annum during the time period that they had control over the diamond fields.
The IUF were about to get more rich pickings. The army overthrew the president and invited the rebels into Freetown as allies. Almost immediately, the RUF set about pillaging the capital in what they cynically called Operation Pay Yourself.
We went house to house looting. We took belongings, demanded money, and sometimes killed two or three of their family members.
It was a war of stealing, grabbing, and taking illegally what you never worked for.
People were being forced into their houses. People, this was the time I had to go into hiding. You hear people being shot at. You hear people crying, rebels attacking them, women being brutalized. They were being raped in front of their children, in front of their husbands, in front of their family members.
Every town was hell, to put it very crudely. There was complete anarchy and instability in this country.
The horror ended only when a Nigerian-led intervention force drove the RUF out of the capital. But by then, 6,000 people had perished. Corpses piled up outside Freetown's hospitals.
The dead bodies that I saw, perhaps up to the day I die, I pray not to see that many dead people.
And a once vibrant city was in ruins. Finally, the international community intervened. The warring parties met in Lome, Togo, in July 1999 and signed a peace accord.
It called for a complete cessation of hostilities from all parties. It also granted amnesty to all the fighting forces, including the RUF. It also called for some power sharing.
The Lome Peace Accord, probably one of the worst things that have been done in Africa in many, many, many years.
To the horror of many in Sierra Leone, Fode Sanko, leader of the RUF, was handed the vice presidency.
People said there will never be a military solution to this. There has to be a political solution. The political solution was to give the vice presidency of the country to a butcher.
As vice president, Sanko was granted official oversight of Sierra Leone's diamond mines. The very objective he had sought through 8 years of war. Halfway across the world, a Canadian pressure group called Partnership Africa Canada was working on peace-building projects for Sierra Leone.
And one of the Sierra Leoneans in the group said, this thing is really about diamonds. Until somebody does something about diamonds, this thing will never be over. We began to research the subject, and sure enough, diamonds really were the heart of the matter.
In January 2000, Partnership Africa Canada published a scathing report that exposed how diamonds funded the RUF's brutal war. The report also pointed the finger at De Beers. Although they'd closed their Sierra Leone office in 1985, the report claimed that De Beers were almost certainly purchasing Sierra Leone blood diamonds unwittingly, after they'd been smuggled out of the country.
You can't buy them in the country where they're mined, then you buy them somewhere else. In the end, they're all going to go into the same pot. So certainly they were buying diamonds that had been smuggled from a whole variety of places.
De Beers itself did not buy any Sierra Leone diamonds from 1985 onwards, but clearly there were problems in terms of those diamonds from that country getting into certain channels, being smuggled and getting onto the international markets.
Most diamonds were smuggled out through neighboring country, Liberia.
In a two-year period, over $2 billion worth of diamonds had come into Antwerp, supposedly from Liberia.
Yet none of these diamonds came from Liberia. Liberia itself has very few diamonds. This is a country that can't produce $10 million worth of diamonds a year.
The report also showed that invoices were often falsified by listing a diamond shipment's last country of transport and not its country of origin.
Many, many diamonds went through Swiss free ports, and so these were declared as Swiss diamonds. Switzerland, of course, doesn't have any diamonds.
As negative press about blood diamonds spread, the industry took notice. De Beers was the first to act.
De Beers began to recognize that this was a real issue, and as the industry leader, they would have to make some changes in the way they do business.
They realized that they actually had to do something for whatever reasons, whether it was altruistic or whether it was to protect the good name of diamonds. They did become involved.
In 2000, De Beers stopped buying diamonds on the open market, ending a practice that had been central to their business since the beginning.
And basically said they would only buy diamonds from mines that they controlled or had a share in, so they knew exactly where the diamonds came from.
When we look at the absolute tragedy that was going on in Sierra Leone, this shocked the world and it shocked the diamond industry. And we very quickly wanted to become part of the solution in putting an end to this. Diamonds should have nothing to do with these kind of activities.
For an industry that had altered very little in over a century, it was a dramatic change.
The awareness of conflict diamonds is probably the biggest change to the diamond industry, almost from the beginning.
But just as the diamond industry finally took action, in Sierra Leone, the RUF rose again. The RUF rebels had broken the ceasefire and were on the rise once again. But this time, the world was determined to defeat them once and for all. In May 2000, a British intervention force landed on the shores of Sierra Leone. Together with UN troops, they crushed the RUF and arrested their leader, Fode Sanko. When Sierra Leoneans went freely to the polls, President Kabar was re-elected. Hundreds of citizens whose hands had been cut off to keep them from voting bravely cast their ballots.
Today, we're happy that those flames of war have been extinguished and that now we're about to watch the flames of peace destroy some of the implements of war.
But the peace in Sierra Leone is an uneasy one. Full amnesty was granted to RUF combatants. So war victims and the rebels who terrorized them are once again neighbors.
And most of us consider the civil war as a long nightmare, and people are prepared to forgive, not necessarily to forget, and to forge ahead in the hope that they will never experience this kind of atrocities again.
The Sierra Leone Truth and Reconciliation Commission urges victims and perpetrators to find common ground. Killers are asked to offer remorse.
Some people have died, some got lost. So all these people who, in one way or the other, fell victim of the war, we are to say sorry to them, and I extend my sympathy to them.
Victims are asked to forgive. Not all can.
I'm not going to feel fine.
It doesn't feel good. Sometimes I ask God to give me the power to meet the person who did this to me. We wouldn't be able to sit down like this and talk.
For Kumba Mbindi too, the torment of the war is ever present.
We are still here and going through a lot of pain. We have suffered a great deal.
The sexual assault she suffered at the hands of the RUF still casts a shadow over her life.
My husband doesn't care for me anymore. He is gone and I'm here by myself. There is no other man here. Even those I go out with that want me, once they sleep with me and realize my condition, they walk away.
But Kumba Mbindi will never have an opportunity to see her attackers brought to justice. Because very few RUF rebels will ever be prosecuted. Sierra Leone's UN-backed War Crimes Tribunal will deal only with those who bear the greatest responsibility for the war's worst atrocities. Fore Sanko was charged with crimes against humanity, but died in prison before he could be sentenced. But the verdict on Blood Diamonds is clear.
Blood Diamonds are the common thread that bound together this criminal enterprise. The rule of the gun reigns supreme.
And the peace has changed little for those still toiling in the diamond mines. Ousmane Konté was kidnapped by the RUF during the war and forced to mine for diamonds. He's still mining. Without education or skills, it's the only work he can find. He remains a captive to diamonds.
At this job, I haven't had anything yet. I am still trying. If I had another job, I could leave the mining job. But since I don't have another, I will stay here until God gives me something else.
Some diggers receive a tiny share of what they find. Others earn a scant living.
The mining conditions are awful. People dig in the hot sun all day long, often up to their waist in filthy water. There's no social cohesion. There's a lot of violence. These mining areas are great vectors for malaria, for HIV/AIDS, for all kinds of societal problems.
A new project, the Diamond Development Initiative, seeks to deal with the issue of blood diamonds in a new way, by shifting the balance of power back to the miners themselves.
There are a million, if not a million and a half, artisanal alluvial diamond diggers earning a dollar a day. What we're suggesting with the Diamond Development Initiative, the DDI, is that you need economic solutions to economic problems. But if you can get better prices for the diggers, if you can formalize this vast informal diamond economy, then you can bring peace and development to the diamond areas.
There can be no future as long as the people that are working in these areas do not benefit. We believe that the communities, first of all, are the priority.
Why is it that a diamond in Sierra Leone can be bought for $20 and then sold in Antwerp for $1,500? It's perverse. What really needs to happen is for the diamond industry and for governments to actually start investing in their development, to start paying a decent wage to the people that are working there, but also a realistic price for the diamonds.
Until that happens, Ousmane Konté and tens of thousands like him will continue to toil in Africa's diamond mines. But what of blood diamonds themselves? The diamond industry, governments, and the UN have recently introduced the Kimberley Process, an elaborate system of certification designed to eliminate the trade in blood diamonds once and for all. To date, more than 70 countries have signed up.
I think one of the indications of success in the Kimberley Process is what's happened in Sierra Leone. In 2002, I think Sierra Leone exported about $26 million worth of diamonds legally. In 2005, it exported $142 million legally.
It's estimated that conflict diamonds have now been reduced to less than 1% of the world's diamond trade. But already, there are cracks in the system. Illicit stones, mined by rebels in Ivory Coast, Liberia, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, are still finding their way into the international diamond market.
People who are trading conflict diamonds are taking them from conflict zones and bringing them into South Africa and then insinuating them into the South African system through the auctions in South Africa. And then once they appear in the auctions in South Africa, they are certified as legitimate diamonds. So you've got a real problem of policing what's going on in the so-called legitimate diamond selling and diamond trading countries.
The blood diamond story is not over. In regions as volatile as West and Central Africa, where poverty and political instability go hand in hand, a war funded by diamonds could easily be triggered once again.
Diamonds are forever.
Yeah.
They won't leave in the night. I've no fear that they might desert me.
FNF, forever. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? Forever. I figure, I feel like I should just, you know, show people the other side that wasn't aware, you know what I'm saying? That are presently unaware, that don't know about it, you know what I'm saying? You know, just show them it's another side to this thing right here. We call blame. Yeah. Allow me to break down the game behind the bracelets, earrings, chains, watches, and rings. The blame, the crystal encrusted princess flooded, canary studded, blue colored and blood stained. Yeah, the older brother of the drug game, the giver of fame, the takeawayer of lame, the empowerer of the kings that came with claims and disease to leave where the native peoples were staying. Believe, mine engagement ring receiving floss at the cost of a bonded child minus pain. Long ago, kings used to wear them in their armor when they fought other armies because they used to scare them. If you wasn't rich, couldn't wear them. Witches used to marry them, they'd shoot you before they share them. The gift and the curse, the venom and the serum. Most hated lady's best friend, get murked for a clever.
Diamonds are forever.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying?
Diamonds are,
and I ain't coming down on nobody, you know what I'm saying? I ain't trying to judge nobody or nothing like that. You know what I'm saying? I've lost too. I might go get me a pinky ring tomorrow, you know what I'm saying? But just want you to see, man, you know what I'm saying? Just see, man. Cecil Rhodes sold woe and genocide into the countryside just to get his shine on. I fear what De Beers and his peers used to do before the world really knew, just to get their mind on. Making paper with slave labor and hitting little kids with lifetime beards, making them cut and shine stones. Inflating the price and making them look nice, and I wasn't thinking twice when I was putting my own. About a young shorty in Sierra Leone or the conflict countries that people call home. I figured I would never go to Angola, so it never did affect me. That maybe indirectly, that my necklace was funding a rebellion or a military coup started by militias that don't believe in following none of Geneva's rules. I was brushing off the haters, trying to be cool. Didn't have a clue that the rapper was helping the rapers, raiders of the villages, pillagers of the schools, shooters of the innocents, torturers of the witnesses, burners of the businesses, and my bracelet was the fuel. I ain't pushing an agenda, homie, I'm just pushing the facts. Fuck Bush, cause it's people doing worse on this earth, and they black. I took it that year, now let me bring it back. We all know on foreign shores that they finance wars, but ask yourself, do they finance yours? When I first got mine, I took them out on tour. They know they lost half their value when I took them out the store. Oh, it was full of moissanites and cubics, but the jeweler knew I was stupid and that I couldn't prove it. Feeling like I need it, because I do music to impress the groupies and the interviewers. So I didn't appraise it, nor did I loop it. Even gave them to my girl, thinking I was Cupid. Homies was on hit, hoping they can make me lose it. Creeping through my own hood, knew I had to remove it. I see the Russian mafia, the the Jewish mobsters, the undercover terrorists, and the traps for the hustlers. Homie, it's a rap for the nonsense rhyming. Props to Kanye, I call it conflict diamonds. You know what I'm saying? I felt like I should just let y'all know that. You know what I'm saying? Make y'all aware. So many people do things to glorify them. I felt like it was time for somebody to do something that were horrifying. You know what I'm saying? But you never thought that